Hi, everybody, and welcome to Kremlin File. I'm here with Olga. Hey, Olga.
Hi.
Hey. Today, we're going to be talking with Edward Lucas, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis, CEPA, and he was formerly a senior editor of The Economist. Edward has been a distinguished guest of ours in season one. Now, we're talking about the weaponization of hunger.
This is a very, common Soviet tactic, and Putin has been taking Russia back to the Soviet Union. It's the same Soviet mentalities, same Soviet system, except he hijacked the system and kind of, you know, put his cronies and made it more kleptocratic because of the access to the West and parking all the money in the West. But I mean, Russia is known for, you know, they were starving their people. They starved Ukrainians. They absolutely hold zero regard for human life. There was reports that they were going to send mobile crematories to, to follow their soldiers to kind of dispose of who died. And after now, we're close to, if not over 30,000 Russian soldiers who have died. And, you know, and for the West, that is a huge, huge figure. For Russia, they're more than willing to sacrifice a million deaths without acknowledging them, hiding it, you know, cremating them. Now there are reports that they're burying their soldiers in Belarus, so their family never even see the remains. So, I mean, this is how Russia is. They have zero regard. I mean, the leadership's never cared about people. They have zero regard, you know, if they send untrained soldiers that they plucked out of, you know, villages as cannon fodder. And that's it, you know. So absolutely, the fact that they're weaponizing hunger, this is something, you know, that they've done over the centuries. And they're using the same tactics again as blackmail against the free world, you know, because they want to create the instability in hopes that
that's right.
If they continue, you know, as they continue their assault on Ukraine, that the West will buckle and that the free world will buckle because of the high, you know, gas prices and the shortages of food that are coming this fall and, you know, and just the whole economic instability.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, this is something we're going to ask Edward right away. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because of I was also reading something that, I mean, they're pushing, as you said, for, they said, I think it was Lavrov, if I'm not mistaken, his latest statement. Okay. You want the grain, then lift the sanctions. You know, this is the same old, same old, same old.
Yeah.
But absolutely. Yeah. But are we going to buckle, Olga? No, we are not going to buckle.
The West, if they don't learn right now, and if they, you know, give in to Russia, the problems in the next few years are going to be 10 times worse than what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
Because right now it's contained in Ukraine and it's, you know, poor Ukrainians are dying every single day for the world to stop Russia there. You know, but if Ukraine falls, trust me, that is only the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, we will see Russia continue marching through Europe, you know, ramp up their operations and attacks against United States, against Canada, and anyone and everyone who, you know, came together to help Ukraine.
Yeah.
So right now, I mean, we can't buckle. I mean,
no, we can absolutely not. And I laugh when I hear people say to me, yeah, but it's costing a lot. And I sat there and I said, well, A, Ukrainians are paying with their life.
Okay? Yeah.
And they are protecting us. B, you haven't seen anything yet if you think that this is what it costs to be able to counter, you know, Russia in all its dimension, the sense of, let's say, what you were talking about, for example. I know that the last shipment for Italian weapons, whatever few weapons they are sending, that kit went out last week. And we got a cyber attack right away. And we got all sorts of disinformation that was pumped out through the pipelines into the Italian media and mainstream. And this is what's happening. So anytime one of the countries decides, okay, let's do something, boom, No, they get
because Russia is a mafia state, and it's a mafia state that uses their intelligence services to intimidate, harass, bully, and destroy other countries. And this is what they do, and this is what they will always do. I mean, you know, with Putin, before Putin, I mean, we've had the same story over and over and over. You know, the whole system honestly needs to be destroyed. But this is the mentality, and this is what they do. And this is why their playbook is so predictable and why we're in a better position, because we actually know what they're going to do. I mean, you know, I've been discussing Russia forever and, you know, putting out warnings, and people are like, how did you know this? Because this is what they do.
They do.
This
is exactly. They
repeat it, you know, they'll kind of adjust their playbook. But for the most part, it is as expectable, as expected as the sun rising.
That's right.
So, I mean.
That's right. And the one thing that we ask everybody to do, and this took a long time for me personally, is to let go of our Western mentality and think that Putin is going to act the way we do. It doesn't work that way. And I have to thank all of my Ukrainian and Russian friends and you, dear Olga, for having to know that actually helped us understand, get out of that mentality and get into trying to understand the way it operates. Look at the actions. What does it do? Not what does it say it does, right? So it's, if that made sense.
Well, that's everything. I mean, that's the whole problem over the past few decades of why the West failed to stop Putin. One of the problems, is because he just bought so many people. The other problem is because they, you know, people formulate their foreign policy off of Western thinking. Mm-hmm. And like I said, with the, you know, military soldiers dying in the West, you know, if a military, say an American soldier dies on the field, first of all, his battalion will do everything to secure the body, to bring it home. To them, that is important. They, you know, even, I mean, they'll take every single risk to bring the soldier home. And then, you know, when he gets home, there's proper, you know, burials and it's sentimental and people in the country remember what he sacrificed. And, you know, in Russia, absolutely not. I mean, yes, they have their, you know, circus propaganda, like a medal distribution.
Right.
But when it comes to something that is not, does not fit in to their image, then they hide it. And you see with Moskva, you know, the sinking of Moskva, they hid all those deaths. The family members received zero answers. You know, you see with the soldiers, the family members, the dead soldiers, which is close to 30,000, the family members have received nothing. And Russia doesn't care about life. They do not care how many people died. They don't care. And that's the big difference. They don't care. I mean, Ukraine had one of the biggest problems over the in the first month of the war, Russian dead soldiers laying on their streets and no one's coming to pick them up.
I mean,
what kind of country, you know, does that? And no Western mentality, you can imagine, you know, that you have, I don't know, at that time it was 10,000, you know, soldiers scattered on streets with no one coming to get you, no one caring. Maybe someone threw you in a ditch if it was, you know, good enough, but that's it, you know? So, I mean, this is, there's a huge difference in mentality. I mean, and just, you know, Russians clearly have the most expertise because of what happens domestically there to people. And then Ukrainians obviously get, you know, have been under going attacks for the past three decades almost from Russia since the collapse. So,
So without any further ado, Edward, welcome back to Kremlin's File.
Thank you.
Edward, the world has changed since the last time we spoke. We spoke in the summer, if I'm not mistaken. And we were talking about all sorts of security issues, so on and so forth. So we're going to just jump in to what is happening exactly now. And I wanted to touch on an article that came out that you wrote called Hunger Games. And everyone, you can find it in SIPA. Because what we're seeing, Edward, is that we'll get into Ukraine, and we also want to talk about NATO okay, as well, and all the huge developments that's happening there. But one thing that did strike me is we're seeing Russia weaponize everything, okay, when we think of, right? And we've seen it, before the war, information warfare. We've had energy warfare. And now we're also seeing the weaponization of hunger that you wrote about, and also of migration that might ensue. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? It's really important that we get this information out to people.
Well, thanks, Monique. And I'm sorry we're going in this direction, because I think there was a kind of honeymoon, if one could call it that, at the beginning of this terrible war in Ukraine, where we felt that all the sacrifice and heroism of the Ukrainian people was kind of in a way worth it if it had woken up the West to the shape and the scope and the dimensions of the threat from Russia. And I'm beginning to feel that honeymoon didn't last very long. And although the Russian attack is bogged down on the battlefield and they're devoting enormous amounts of effort to making quite small gains in the east of Ukraine, I feel on the diplomatic front, Russia's doing much better than we thought, that the Western unity is looking, if not exactly crumbling, at least squishy. And the fears of the hunger, both in humanitarian terms and the political effect of a big famine in the autumn, are changing the political calculus in a way that suits Vladimir Putin. And I'm worried about that.
Yeah, I think we all are. Right, Olga? This is something.
Absolutely, that... because we've seen, like with Italy, and how Putin is like, if you play his game and overlook what the atrocities he's coming in Ukraine, then he'll give you the deals. He'll provide you the food. He'll continue on. And for countries who are taking a firm stand, he, is cutting off energy, cutting off today. They cut off the Dutch energy. So we're seeing this happening, and it's, now it's happening at a critical time because we have a widespread assault on Ukraine with, atrocities coming out, mass graves. And I mean, every day it's just getting more and more, worse information.
Yeah. And also the EU today came, I think it was yesterday, late last night or early today. I've been doing exams all day, so I wasn't able to find out exactly when, but there is a sixth sanctions package that has come out. Mm-hmm. And, have you been following that, Edward? Can you give us a little bit of information about that? And
yes,
if you're satisfied with it?
Well, I think it's impressive that the EU is still moving forward, and everything that we're seeing now would have been thought of as unimaginable only 6 months ago. I think the problem is that this latest round of sanctions has a big question about timing. It's about getting Russian seaborne oil off the European shopping list, but Russian pipeline oil is still coming, and it's still coming particularly to Hungary, which has negotiated a kind of get-out clause. Mm-hmm. Now, it's true that Hungary, which is landlocked like Austria and some of the other Central European countries, doesn't have easy access to seaborne crude, so they're dependent on the pipelines. One might ask, why are you so dependent on the pipelines, and why didn't you diversify earlier? But I think that, to me, the main lesson of this is not so much the squeeze it's putting on Russia probably sometime next year when it really bites. It shows the ability of the Hungarian government under Viktor Orban to make its own rules. And it's worth remembering that Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, which is effectively the EU's government, flew to Budapest to try and push the Hungarians into accepting the collective oil embargo, and she didn't succeed. And this is troubling. We have members of the EU which are not playing by the same rules as everybody else, and there doesn't seem to be much the EU can do about it.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, people, influences, and experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
In fact, the first thing that came to mind while I was reading about it, just very, you know, on a superficial level, was this really looks like a victory for Orban. I'm not sure whether we could interpret it, but you've said it yourself. It's something that is extremely, it's troubling and it's worrying, because going forward, I think we're going to have to show even more unity and not, no slack off.
And it's also troubling, I mean, in a NATO context, it's troubling because Hungary is also a NATO member, and it underlines the difficulties that the alliance, the NATO alliance, will have at 30. And it also reminds us that with the problems we have with Turkey. And I'm interested to see, getting back to the hunger thing, that there's been a phone call with President Erdogan of Turkey, apparently talking to Putin about getting some kind of naval, merchant navy traffic freighters going out of Odessa with Ukrainian grain on board. Now, I obviously, it's better to have the grain than not to have the grain, but I wonder what the conditions are here and what sort of bargain Putin's driving, and whether Erdogan is playing on the same team as us while he negotiates that.
Yeah.
Edward, so when Russia launched their assault on Ukraine, they were calculating, you know, on the long, playing the long game. And the long game is, you know, waiting for cracks in the alliance. I mean, they didn't expect to have such unity in the alliance. But when they saw it, they were waiting for cracks in the alliance. They were waiting for media coverage to wane. And, you know, in the same time, ramp up their disinformation operations in order to kind of muddle the truth of what is happening in Ukraine. And we're seeing specifically Germany being targeted, you know, where they're putting out a lot of disinformation that Ukrainians are the ones committing the mass graves and creating the mass graves and committing all the atrocities. How do you see this alliance going? Because we've seen a very troubling thing over the past, I would say, a few weeks, you know, with this now new train of thought, or Kremlin train of thought, that Ukraine should, you know, just be okay with ceding land to make everything, you know, the war stop. So where do you see this going? Because this,
well,
this is now
again,
like...
again and again, we make the mistake of trying to fit Russia and the Kremlin and Putin's decision-making into a Western frame of analysis. So it's quite true that Putin's made a number of huge miscalculations. He didn't tell his military what sort of tasks they were facing. They were badly briefed. They didn't have the right supplies and ammunition. They had huge military setbacks. Wow, what a terrible mistake for Putin. Well, Putin just finds another, you know, finds more soldiers and more equipment and does something else. We say, look, Putin's plan A was to take Kiev in 72 hours. It was going to be the Prague Spring all over, you know, the crushing of the Prague Spring all over again. There'd be no resistance. Wow, did he miscalculate? Well, yeah, he miscalculated on that too. But he's got a new plan. You know, you go from plan A to plan B to plan C to plan D. And what we, I think, miss here is that the Kremlin is able just to revise its objectives and its tactics and to keep going in a way that perhaps the Western leadership, under scrutiny from lawmakers and the media and civil society and so on, might not. And so we're now in a, as you said, in a situation where Putin is fighting a war of attrition. It's a war of attrition on the ground. It's also a war of attrition when it comes to willpower. And he thinks that his willpower is stronger than the West's willpower, because it always has been in the past. And I fear he may be right. There's the third front, which Gideon Rackman wrote about in the FT very well today, which is the economic attrition. And maybe the time will come when Putin runs out of money and runs out of equipment because of Western sanctions. I'm skeptical about that because I think Russia has immense reserves of ability to get around things. And so long as they can keep on firing dumb munitions and hurling conscripts in battle, they may keep going for longer than we think. But it's if there's a note of hope, it's that the economic attrition is the one where the West has the upper hand and Russia has is in an inferior position.
Hi, this is Rachel Yucatel, and I'm here to invite you to listen to my podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. This podcast delves into the lives of those who have been reduced to a single headline. Each episode will take a closer look at the stories of those who are on a mission to change their narrative. Join me as we uncover the truth behind the misconceptions, shed light on the stories of those who have perhaps been wrongfully portrayed, explore the complexities of the human experience, and celebrate the power of second chances. Who doesn't love a good comeback story?
I have one question about France and Germany, Edward. Now that you're talking about, let's say, the long game and the war of attrition, is this what is also in the calculus of France and Germany, that they believe that we're going forward? How do you view and interpret what is coming out of there right now?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to interpret this. I think that Macron loves the idea of being the deal maker. Mm-hmm. And there is always a danger that he will break ranks, try and phone Putin, try and do a deal, because he has this great desire for the limelight. And I believe there's now a new verb in Russian and others. Yeah. Slavic languages of Macronich, yeah. Which is to Macron.
Macronized.
And I've also heard of people saying, and there's a German word, Scholz, which is to behave like Scholz. And these are obviously ornaments to our dictionaries, but I'm not sure they help much with our diplomacy. I think that with Germany, there is still a sea change. I don't discount the idea of this Zeitenwende. And I think that given where Germany's come from, this is still a big deal, but it's painfully slow. And we see a lot of rather kind of vacuous public philosophizing, with Scholz tweeting, can one really secure peace without only by peaceful means? And this has a sort of sophomoric tone to it, as the Germans sort of debate ponderously their place in the world and the way the world works. Meanwhile, every day, hundreds of people are being killed and maimed, yes. And thousands are losing their homes. And I find it quite the kind of arrogance of the Germans in thinking they have all the time in the world to make their mind up. It's quite stunning. But on the other hand, it's better to have Germany making its mind up than not making its mind up. So I think that things are still moving forward in Germany. But it's difficult. I was on a panel with a Ukrainian MP yesterday, who was saying, Kira Luko, who was saying that we haven't getting weapons from Germany, we actually only got helmets. Wow. Maybe there's a bit more than helmets have come, but given the enormous quantities of what the United States is sending and the enormous efforts that the Estonians and Lithuanians particularly are making relative to their size, and the substantial amount that Britain's doing, Germany, given its enormous economic weight on the continent of Europe, is in a shamefully low position in terms of how it's helping.
Yeah.
With Germany and France, do you see the going forward in Europe, the power shifting from Germany and France to Eastern Europe? Because the Eastern European countries, have created such a strong alliance, and they've been proven right, because, everything we're seeing now is what they've been, sounding the alarm on over the past few decades, because they are Russia's neighbor. And, they've one way or another underwent these attacks, not like this, but, in pieces. So do you see the power shifting away eventually from Germany and France?
Well, I think Katharina Crook put it very well, in a tweet today, where she said the moral center of gravity in Europe has shifted east. And really, President Zelensky, since the start of the war, has been the leader of the free world in a way that is really impressive. I don't think anyone since Reagan has had that sort of combination of strategic and rhetorical abilities. And Germany's sort of self-declared role as the custodian of the country, of the continent's morals, I think is looking very, very tattered now. And the, you know, the there's a lot in German in Germany about how, you know, we're a very good country and we do good things, and it was sort of slightly self-satisfied. And you get this in Sweden as well as some other countries. But I think that's, you know, that's definitely changed. And if the Germans say, well, because of our terrible history, we have to be particularly sort of moral and high-minded now, people just laugh because they're being naive and selfish. But I think that there's really a kind of vacuum on the Western side of the continent. You have France, which talks but doesn't act, Germany, which talks and doesn't talk and doesn't act, the European Commission with extremely unimpressive senior leaders. I don't think anybody really knows. He would be able to tell you exactly who Charles Michel is or what he does. And as I mentioned earlier, von der Leyen hasn't been particularly effective. And I forget the name of the other fellow. So I'm being ironic there. I think there is a vacuum, and that's partially filled by President Zelensky. It's partially filled by Kaja Kallas of Estonia, and it's to some extent filled by President Biden. But I think that's what. So it's not so much that leadership is really shifting; it's that we have a leadership vacuum on the continent, and it's filled by a handful of admirable politicians from the eastern side. I'd also mention maybe Gabrielis Landsbergis from Lithuania, and President Čaputová from Slovakia, who's just visited Kiev. But it's really hard to imagine a time, or to think of a time, when the European political class has been less impressive, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I would agree. Olga, you had your questions?
Yes. So with Finland and Sweden now being eager to become, the latest NATO members, and now they want to join, we see Turkey as, you know, putting a stop to it. Two questions. One, do you see Turkey, are they doing this for concessions to see what they could gain out of it? And do you see it going through? And also, what do you see the threat to Finland and Sweden from Russia? Do you see them going through on the threats of if Finland and Sweden join, that they will attack them, and, you know, and all the other propaganda that comes out of the Kremlin?
I think that Turkey is bargaining hard because Turkey can, and the stuff they may want to get back into the F-35 program. Maybe they're looking for concession to the United States. Maybe they want some sort of cooperation on the presence of Kurdish emigres who they don't like in Stockholm. It'll be tricky. The Swedish minority government, I think, rests on the support of one MP who is a sort of, in particular, from a Kurdish background, and it will be difficult for them to do anything on that, leaving aside all the legal and other obstacles of accepting Turkish interference in Sweden's internal affairs. But I have a feeling this will be sorted out in one way or another, and it may be that Sweden will end up owing the United States quite a lot for some intervention the United States makes with Turkey. But it also underlines this kind of general shambles within NATO, which is at this scale and with this lack of cohesion is not tremendously effective. And I think that also reflects the situation in the Baltic Sea region, that there are a number of very serious problems there, which I've outlined in reports over the years, ranging from lack of a maritime strategy, lack of pre-positioned stocks, a completely incomprehensible command structure, lack of the AMD, air and missile defense assets in the Baltic states, which are the ones that most need them, problems with ISR, intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, which is partly due to the NATO non-NATO divide, poor military mobility, it's difficult to get stuff around. Now, all those problems become more fixable as a result of Sweden and Finland joining. So the intelligence sharing, for example, just isn't a problem anymore. And other problems, we are in a position now where we can solve. It doesn't mean they're solved, but they are more solvable. Command structure, for example. I think the problem is that the most vulnerable bit of the Baltic Sea region is the Suwalki-Alytus corridor, that narrow bit of land between Poland and Lithuania. And that really relies on the United States being there in substantial numbers to protect it. And there's a big question over that, because the United States can't carry all the do all the heavy lifting on its own. There aren't many other countries that are able to do it. Strategically, it's troubling to be overly dependent on the United States anyway, because what happens if we get a change of administration? And so that problem what's the American connection in the Baltic? It's really difficult. But what the other worry, which is related to this, is that the United States and other countries may say, let's outsource defense of the Baltic Sea region to the Swedes and the Finns and the Danes and the Norwegians and the Poles. There you have countries that are big, case of Poland, countries that are advanced, in the case of the Nordics, and countries that are vulnerable, in the case of the Baltic states. So let's stick all that together and let them get on with it. And the trouble with that is you then end up without the kind of military mass and the nuclear guarantee and so on. So the Balts are really quite worried about that. They don't want to be outsourced to the Finns and Swedes. They want to have lots of American soldiers and, you know, maybe some British ones as well on the ground. So I'm afraid I'm troubled by that. I think it's going to be a difficult question for the next couple of years, even absent an immediate Russian military threat.
Okay. Lots of problems to solve. Lots of problems to solve going forward. But at least we're looking at them, whereas before these were not even up to, I mean, in our conversation during the summer, Edward, okay, we weren't even there, no, in talking
about
these things.
You're right, you're right. You know, it's best to have a to-do list than not have
exactly.
Even better to start doing.
Yeah, and just, if I can just, can I rob two more minutes from you?
Yeah.
Is that possible? Yeah, just one last thing. We do have the problem of trying to get the grain out of Ukraine. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, because that is something that is so important to do. Is there a way of solving this at all? Or are we just going to have to, I don't know.
Well, I think what I've been saying at the beginning of this, since the beginning of this, is we're going to have a confrontation with Russia sooner or later. It's best to have the confrontation while we still have a functioning Ukrainian state. Rather than waiting until Ukraine is crushed in a sort of Syria-style war of attrition, and then we're confronting Russia without Ukraine and perhaps in less favourable territory like the Baltic states. So I think the fundamental question is, are we willing to confront Russia? And if we're willing to confront Russia and take their, you know, look at their escalation dominance and say, we have even more dominant escalation dominance. You know, you threaten us with nuclear weapons, we turn every computer in Russia into a brick in the space of 6 hours, because we can do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the stuff we could do, if we're willing to do that, then the grain problem becomes secondary. Until you're willing to do that, then the grain problem is very big. But I see the grain problem as basically a symptom of our irresolute attitude. Okay. We have the naval and other power. We have the financial firepower to ensure the ships. We have, you know, we could do this if we wanted to. The real problem is we don't want to do it.
Okay. In fact, I think it's the slow pace. I think we're all feeling very, very frustrated right now that we're not hitting this very hard, and we should.
Well, if we feel frustrated, just imagine how the Ukrainians feel.
Exactly.
And to wrap up, Edward, where do you see this going over the summer? Because right now the war is, you know, still contained in Ukraine. There were some scares that Russia was laying groundwork, you know, to move into Transnistria, Ossetia, you know, and cause instability in Georgia. Do you see it pouring out, you know, into Europe? And do you see where do you see going in the next 3 months?
The military will continue in a sort of, you know, creeping war of attrition. And I suspect we'll see some more Russian gains. You may see some Ukrainian counterattacks in places. But I don't think that from a military point of view, Ukraine can mount a big counterattack, because that requires a combination of maneuverability and firepower that they don't have at the moment. They can disrupt the Russian campaign very severely. I don't think we're going to get to talks, because we aren't in the kind of mutually hurting stalemate where talks become possible. I think the Ukrainians still feel that the current system is intolerable, but they have a chance of pushing back. I think Western weapons will continue to make a difference in Ukraine, although logistics are a very serious problem. And I think until the midterms, America, the administration will continue to do what it's doing, which is throwing a lot of money and equipment at the problem, but not perhaps the political will that is needed for a decisive intervention. And that, I fear, is going to be that. So much more suffering, much more destruction, fatigue in Europe, some signs of disunity. And we will look back on this and say, why did we went, you know, Why is all this cost we're bearing now, if we just spent 1/100th mm-hmm. of what were of the cost and risk we're bearing now before the war, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Edward, I think we're going to leave it off on that.
It's great being on the show. Call me again.
Thank you, Edward.
Thanks, Edward. Hey, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is a Bunker Crew Media production hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monique Camara, with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordi Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Frankel and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarra. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.